Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the Huckabee surge is officially the campaign story of the moment. How did the supposedly second-tier Republican contender become the man to beat? And what has the national media done to boost him to front-runner status? We'll speak with a reporter who's covered Huckabee up close for years, Max Brantley of the Arkansas Times. Also on Counterspin today, as the U.S. and NATO confront a resurgent Taliban in Afghanistan with increased bombing and even talk of a military surge there, civilian casualties are growing. Despite the changes, the American press is no less dependent on official views than it was when the White House and American journalists were counting Afghanistan in the win column. We'll talk to Professor Mark Harold of the University of New Hampshire and author of The AP Speaks Newspeak about U.S. reporting on Afghanistan. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
One thing you're starting to hear in the mainstream media's election coverage is that the Iraq war just doesn't seem to matter much anymore. A December 5th USA Today story led, quote, "Growing anxiety over the economy, healthcare, and immigration rival Iraq as the central issues in the presidential campaign, shifting an election landscape once dominated by the war," close quote. A discussion on NBC Nightly News on December 9th reached similar conclusions based on new polls from Iowa and New Hampshire. Well, this kind of talk obscures the fact that, according to most national polls, Iraq is still the number one issue of concern for voters. Even that USA Today story had to acknowledge that the war was still the top issue on voters' minds, twice as important as those other topics that are rivaling it for attention. But don't expect pundits to allow inconvenient facts to mess up their storyline. On December 11th, David Brooks' New York Times column was headlined, "The Post-War Election." He seemed to be inspired by Peter Beinart's column in the Washington Post a week earlier, which was titled, "Non-Story Remakes the Race," the non-story being Iraq. Beinart's lead example was the fact that at a recent candidates' debate, there was little talk of the war. Well, if that's true, is that evidence that the public cares less about the war, or that the journalists moderating those debates don't think about it much? They're the ones, after all, who are picking the questions. On December 12th, the deadliest car bombing in months in Iraq killed dozens of civilians. That story was buried deep in the pages of the Washington Post and the New York Times. Was the public responsible for that editorial decision, too?
Mainstream media aren't at all fond of Democratic presidential hopeful John Edwards, but at the Washington Post, the disdain is becoming something of an obsession. On December 6th, the paper attempted to fact-check an Edwards TV ad that attacked corporate Democrats for being unable to deliver meaningful political change. Since the ad's premise can't be proven true or false, the Post's fact-check instead fell into the popular media practice of sneering at Edwards. Quote, "In this narrative, the former plaintiff's lawyer and hedge fund advisor casts himself as the populist outsider who'll take on greedy corporations," close quote. Well, the fact is, there's nothing unusual about a plaintiff's lawyer taking on greedy corporations. That's why they're so despised by corporate media. And perhaps the Post missed it, but since giving up his consulting job, Edwards has championed a policy that would sharply raise taxes on the lightly taxed hedge fund industry. But the Post really let readers know how they felt on December 11th when the paper ran a series of articles on Edwards, four of which mentioned Edwards' expensive haircuts. To be fair, one was a piece about his fashion sense. But Post columnist Dana Milbank scored a twofer that day, slamming Edwards for his wealth and his hair, noting that Edwards' class war rhetoric was odd, quote, "coming from a man with a 28,000-square-foot house, $30 million in assets, and a $400 haircut," close quote. One can only imagine how today's Post would have reported on Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Following the recent national intelligence estimate on Iran, one would have expected Bush's claims about Iran's nuclear threat to have lost all credibility in the media. After all, the report concluded that Iran had ended its nuclear weapons program in 2003. Instead, some journalists rushed to defend Bush. New York Times reporter Tim Weiner, for instance, went along with the administration's claim that Bush was skeptical of the new intelligence report because he was, quote, "burned in the past by bad intelligence," close quote. Well, that's an odd claim, given that the record on Iraq shows that the White House was often guilty of overstating what the CIA was telling them about Iraq, and intelligence officials would spend their time trying to remove false claims from speeches, not always successfully. Well, meanwhile, the LA Times published an article on December 7th under the headline, "Doves Find Fault with Iran Report 2." The LA Times reported that in addition to being criticized by Bush, the new intelligence was also, quote, suddenly raising concerns among the political center and left, close quote. So just who were the doves from the political center and left the LA Times cited? One was Ray Takei, who agreed with Bush's rhetoric even while saying his own politics are to the left of George W. Bush. Well, that's not saying much. This so-called dove was a contributing editor to the National Interest, a magazine published by the Nixon Center and founded by noted neocon Irving Kristol. Another dove cited by the Times was Clinton administration official Gary Samore, who was a prominent advocate of the Iraq War. With doves and journalists like these, who needs hawks?
ABC World News launched a series on healthcare on December 10th. Host Charles Gibson began by noting that most Americans say they're dissatisfied with the system and that, quote, providing healthcare for all Americans is more important than holding down taxes, close quote. He then turned to a few guests to get a sense of the debate. But instead, what viewers got was the certainty that there would be no debate of any substance, since it was taken as a given that the one approach that every other industrialized nation uses to provide healthcare for all of its citizens, and that majority of Americans have repeatedly said they would like to have, was completely off the table. As an opener, Gibson asked, "Let me start with a basic question. Is universal health insurance, universal health care, an attainable goal?" To which Gail Walensky, a former Medicare administrator, answered yes. Gibson's second question was the tell. "And can you get there without it being a government program?" To which Walensky responded, "Absolutely," a sentiment endorsed by the other two panelists, Drew Altman of the Kaiser Foundation and Karen Davis of the Commonwealth Fund, who said, "I think we all agree on that." And that was that. So you see, avoiding a popular, proven way to achieve what has just been established as what most people want is so fundamental that it's not even a question, it's a premise. Anyone hoping to learn why a single-payer system should be so summarily dismissed was out of luck, because acceptance of the premise seems to be the cost of admission to the conversation. Viewers who stuck around could, on the other hand, hear about the need to, quote, limit the amount of medical care people get, close quote.
And finally, in a December 7th piece titled "China Media Less Aggressive in Foreign Coverage," New York Times reporter Howard French delivered what we call a "them not us" story. That is, a report that takes aim at some foreign problem whose American analog is rarely, if ever, acknowledged. For instance, stories about media concentration in Japan or Italy that fail to mention the same trend in the United States. In this case, ironically enough, the problem is shallow, biased international news coverage in China. Referring to recent crises in Myanmar and Pakistan, French writes that these stories were important, but that, quote, most Chinese newspaper readers had to content themselves with dry, narrowly drawn, and sometimes inaccurate accounts of the events, close quote. French went on to criticize the absence of independent reporting from the scene or any in-depth analysis that referred to China's strategic interests in the countries in question. French summed up the case nicely, writing that, quote, critics say one result of this lack of vigorous independent reporting is that what most Chinese newsreaders know of the world closely conforms with government policy and propaganda, close quote. Let's see, dry, narrow, and inaccurate foreign coverage that doesn't pay enough attention to a home country's strategic interests. That does sound bad.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show.
Goes without saying that the national press pay more attention to presidential candidates they think might actually win. For a good bit of the election season, Republican frontrunners like Mitt Romney and Rudy Giuliani were more or less dominating the discussion. But in the last few weeks, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee has snuck his way into that top tier, more or less to everyone's surprise. But how much do voters really know about him? Feature stories on the Baptist minister-turned-politician tell us that he lost a lot of weight and he plays bass guitar. We're joined now by a reporter who spent a little more time getting to know Mike Huckabee, a Huckabee still relatively unknown to the national media. Max Brantley is the editor at the Arkansas Times. He joins us now by phone. Max Brantley, welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
Well, the Huckabee momentum is certainly hard to miss at this point. The cover of Newsweek, long profiles in the big newspapers. The coverage isn't all positive, of course. Huckabee's position on quarantining people with AIDS has been no small part of the equation here. But how did we get here? Who was that Mike Huckabee that the campaign sold to the press?
Well, they sold a charming guy with a knack for making quick quips. Whether they're funny or not, it kind of depends on the audience, I guess. And they wholly focused on that rather than anything about his policies, even though he was talking about some pretty radical things early on, like the fair tax. And best I can tell, they gave no attention at all to his record in Arkansas. But this was invaluable. He was a man without money, but he got a ton of free media. And after a month or so of free media, and the message is all, hey, there's this fresh, funny guy out there. It has some positive impact.
Did they sell Huckabee the same way to the local media when he was running for governor as well?
Well, he was to a certain degree when he ran for lieutenant governor, mm-hmm. which was his first successful run for office. He was an ingratiating person, and he worked very hard at media relations. He's a media professional. I think the rubber really met the road when he started governing, and he started doing things that needed to be reported about. And that's where we started to see another side of Mike Huckabee.
Now, you draw some parallel to George Bush's coverage in 1999, and we saw...
Yeah, I felt George Bush got a free ride in his 2000 election, and I think there's sort of scary parallels with Mike Huckabee. Both are these seemingly likable guys that people are always struck by their personality. I almost fainted yesterday when Mike Huckabee said, the first thing we need to do is unite this country. We need a uniter, not a divider. And I thought, oh boy, we've been through that once, not again.
I've heard that. Well, there was a story in the Washington Post recently about how Huckabee, when he didn't have any money and wasn't anywhere in the polls, he was cultivating the national columnists and the pundits. Made me think about his relations with the media in Arkansas. I know you've had a few run-ins with him. What has it been like over the years, Huckabee's relationship with the local press?
Well, it's good until they write critically about him, then it's bad, and then if they persist in writing critically about him, it gets ugly, and sometimes he'll cut you off, as he did us, and several other reporters, by the way, were cut off, although not to the extent we were, because we've been pretty tough critics, although not universal critics.
And he went after a public television station?
Oh, yeah, there was a host of a show on public television, Roby Brock, who is not really a hard-edged commentator at all, but said some things that Mike Huckabee didn't like, so Huckabee's people put pressure on public television to take him off the air. And Roby Brock sued and won a $15,000 judgment.
That sounds more
settlement,
like,
actually.
Sounds more like Rudy Giuliani than anything else.
He's got a thin skin, but he's been remarkably disciplined in this campaign to not show that side.
Now, part of what you've written about was the kind of unseemly way Huckabee governed while he was in office. Tell us that record, because it seems pretty clear.
Mike Huckabee's record is, I mean, I've often said Bill Clinton had a wandering eye. Mike Huckabee's got sticky fingers. I mean, he loves a freebie. I think most of his sins, be they sins, are pretty small ones. But he raked in hundreds of thousands of dollars of gifts when he first became governor, until the ethics rules changed and he couldn't take them anymore. He sued the Ethics Commission to be able to still take gifts. He plundered a expense account that was supposed to operate the mansion and used it for private expenses. On numerous occasions, he found ways to put money in his family's pocket, his wife's, his own, a babysitter's, out of campaign money. All of these things, and I think Mike Huckabee says, well, I was never found to have done XYZ illegal.
Right.
True enough. Legality is not all. Never been indicted is not necessarily a ringing endorsement for a public official. We know tacky and we know sleazy, and there were times he just appeared that way.
And part of the problem, I suppose, if there is one here, is that some of the official records kind of don't exist anymore.
Well, actually, the Freedom of Information Law in Arkansas is incredibly deficient in one area. It provides a broad exemption for governor's working papers, and I mean, I have a legal argument about how it's been interpreted, but it's been interpreted primarily as a near total exclusion of governor's papers. But beyond that, he went to the extra step of destroying thousands of dollars worth of computer hard drives from the governor's office to make sure none of that information ever fell into anybody's hands ever.
That's usually an issue for a lot of national politicians, destroying the records, but not so much this way. Well, there have been some...
Well, you know, it's Arkansas, they say.
Well, there have been some curious turnabouts recently. Huckabee's moved way to the right on immigration, for example. Part of his appeal to, I think, the national press and some of the pundits is that he's somewhat to the left of the GOP base on things like the environment and tax policy.
Well, I was reading David Broder today, and I'm no admirer of David Broder, saying, wasn't it wonderful what Mike Huckabee said about his support for in-state college tuition for immigrant children? I agree, it was a wonderful thing to say, but how could he write that column today after Mike Huckabee has proposed sending every foreign national in America back to their home company post-haste? It's just there's a disconnect. People see what they want to see in Mike Huckabee.
And his environmentalism is?
Well, what a joke. I mean, he's now posing as a steward of the world, and perhaps he is. There's a great theme in Christianity of conservation, and it would not be unusual for a preacher to be for that. But the facts are, is he ran a terrible Environmental Protection Department in Arkansas that was ineffective at regulating about anything, that we polluted Oklahoma streams with chicken waste. But furthermore, he made a famous speech that's a marker for him early in his career, went before farmers and talked about environmental wackos and how the green people were trying to ruin agriculture. This man has not been a friend of the environment until he found it convenient to do so.
Now, a lot of stories, the unflattering stories that come out in a campaign, come out because another candidate does opposition research. Has that just not happened with the other Republicans in Huckabee?
Well, you know, I think there's some efforts, and I know there's some Arkansas Republicans. He's not very popular among Arkansas Republicans, mm-hmm. by the way, who are in Iowa this week campaigning against him. Some support Fred Thompson. Some just don't like Mike Huckabee. He was not conservative enough for some of them on taxes, which happens to be something that I thought he did pretty well on, oddly enough. But, you know, it's funny. He has established such a persona as the nice guy that the other guys look mean and spiteful when they go after him. And so I think there's a little fear exactly how to approach it.
Yeah, well, about a month ago you wrote this. It was a sort of message to the national press. Come to Arkansas. You'll have to look hard to find a long-term political analyst who'd subscribe fully to the national media narrative about the latest man from Hope, fresh face, funny, nice. It might make life more difficult for you if they were, but have you seen any indication that national campaign
Yes.
reporters are doing this now?
Yes. There are more people in Arkansas now, and I've heard from quite a few this week. I kind of have to tell you, though, I think the damage has been done in the face of some obvious shortcomings. I mean, the remarks on age, which he did not repudiate, his utter cluelessness on the national intelligence estimate, the Wayne DeMond story where his dishonesty about his role continues to multiply. He had a series, his unfortunate or carefully placed remarks about Mormonism, his presentation of himself as a Christian leader, any number of things I think most fair observers would say were setbacks for him, don't seem to have affected him all among the people. I think this is one of those cases that a lot of people talk about, the narrative about Al Gore, the narrative about Mike Huckabee. He's a nice guy, and it doesn't really matter what the facts are. And I'm really fearful we're heading down a repeat of 2000 again.
We've been speaking with Max Brantley. He's the editor of the Arkansas Times. Max Brantley, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Happy to do it.
As the human cost of the war in Afghanistan increases, as the U.S. and its allies face a resurgent Taliban in a war that has some U.S. strategists calling for a military surge there, the changing scenario does not seem to have sparked any new independence in an American press corps which, according to our guest, often fails to dig any deeper than the official statements and handouts. Mark Harold is a professor in the Economics and Women's Studies departments at the University of New Hampshire's Business School. He has been tracking media coverage of Afghanistan since October 2001. His article, The AP Speaks Newspeak, can be read at the news site cursor.org. Mark Harold, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, in a December 4th ABC World News broadcast, anchor Charlie Gibson seemed puzzled by the fact that an ABC poll showed that among Afghans, quote, as many people blame the U.S. and NATO for civilian casualties as blame the Taliban, close quote. What is Charlie Gibson missing about why the U.S. and NATO are increasingly viewed this way by Afghans?
Well, he's not alone in missing that. Let me break this down into maybe three areas, which I think explain what he's talking about. First of all, there's little tangible reconstruction which is taking place on the ground in the south, the east, the center of the country. And this has been widely reported on. There's a wonderful report, research carried out by Oxfam, which came out in November, which details that in excruciating detail, so it's all there. So that's reality. And what you have is you have violence, you have insecurity, you have impunity, you have extortion on the ground. In a large swath of Afghanistan, over half of Afghanistan is subjected to this. This is what people have been living with and increasingly living with. So I think that's a major factor, is that, you know, the promised improvement has not come. And people are tired. Secondly, I think the way that the U.S. forces, and now, of course, since 2003, 2004, NATO forces are carrying out raids, these are the ground attacks here I'm more concerned with, is really turning people against the U.S. and NATO forces. When you have a midnight raid in some hamlet, village, neighborhood, and foreigners come barging into the privacy of an Afghan home, and can come in contact, eyesight, with Afghan women, this is terrible. This is one of the worst things one can do when they rummage through belongings and so on and so forth, throw people out of the home in the middle of the night, later abduct people, beat people. The Afghan National Police, which often accompanies U.S. forces, especially U.S. Special Forces, the Afghan National Police is known to rob, et cetera, et cetera. So that's number two. And number three, which I think is probably the biggest, is that the campaign, the U.S. and NATO campaign, has been carried out preponderantly using air power. And air power causes lots of civilians' death, lots of civilian injury. It causes displacement. And this is something which is going to create resistance. I mean, in a wonderful article by Simon Jenkins for The Guardian, just came out the other day, Britain's Afghan mission is a fruitless and failing pursuit. He says, who knows, he's talking about Mr. Karzai, who knows that every bomb that misses recruits 10 Taliban. And so I think that's what's going on. It's a combination of these three things, in some areas more of one, in others areas more of the other. You know, I don't think this is going to change.
Well, considering those killings of civilians that often happen when the U.S. and NATO bomb in Afghanistan, you've just published a story about one of these incidents that has met with pretty much an official and media blackout here. Tell us a little bit about that.
Absolutely. This is really quite extraordinary. I mean, it is about a raid which occurred on at 2 a.m. at night, November 17, 18th, in the hamlet of Lakari on the Helmand River, of course, in Helmand province. Foreign troops, they're not further identified, but they must be U.S. or British special forces with Afghan soldiers, arrived by air in the village. And what ensued was a gruesome massacre, successfully kept out of sight of the world for almost a month by very effective news management. The story was finally broken by two independent Afghan journalists working for the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. They wrote about it in the Afghan Recovery Report dated December 10th. They interviewed dozens of local villagers who confirmed, in fact, what had happened. And the story was not picked up by the Western media. It was picked up to this very day, so, you know, 3 days later, only by a brief mention in the Daily Telegraph in Britain, and then by the Zurich, Switzerland-based Center for Security Studies. Otherwise, silence. And this is not exceptional. This happens all the time.
Speaking of news management, in your article on Cursor.org, you outline the special role the Associated Press plays in U.S. journalism and how the AP penchant for adopting official language impacts the discussion of Afghanistan. Tell us how the AP speaks newspeak, as you put it in the headline.
In Orwell's newspeak, the idea was to remove any kinds of words, phrases, which could cause rebellion, might elicit critical thinking, questioning, opposition, and so on and so forth. So when you read the AP reports, and I don't want to say it's only the AP, it's not, although I think the AP is more so than Reuters and certainly Agence France-Presse, and there are interesting reasons for that, which I don't have time to get into here. But, you know, if you read the narrative of the AP about an incident in Afghanistan, you'll see the words constantly used, mistakenly bombed, the U.S. forces blundered, they made an error. And then constantly we hear the word coalition, that it, you know, this is a group of countries united in their action to bring whatever change in Afghanistan. You constantly hear the phrase, and this is repeated verbatim. I mean, it's as if these were canned things which had to be put in every article.
Why is it wrong to say mistakenly bombed or made an error?
Well, the errors sometimes occur based on wrong intelligence, but really I think what the alternative narrative would say that these are the direct result of ignorance of local social complexities and reliance upon air war in Afghanistan. It's a direct result of those things, and one could write a lot about that. Many people have. I think it's wrong to speak about a coalition. Increasingly, you have, you know, a split coalition. NATO is in the process of fragmenting over Afghanistan. So I think that, you know, that's another problem. You know, great care for civilians. I don't believe that that's the case, and I document that at great length. Instead, what you have is you have the careless killing of valueless civilians. And I document that in great detail in my website, the Afghan Victim Memorial Project.
Along with this scant media attention to civilian casualties, you've written about how U.S. and allied casualties in Afghanistan are in some ways worse than Iraq because the lethality rate is higher. That is, for the number of soldiers there, more are dying. We're running out of time, Mark Harold, but tell us how listeners can learn more about your work and the Afghanistan Memorial Project.
Well, you can find the website by simply going to Google and putting in the Afghan Victim Memorial Project, and there are a series of things you can click on. If one clicks on the individual names, that will take you to somewhere in the order of 700 or more different incidents over the course of the last 3 years.
We've been speaking with Mark Harold, professor in the economics and business departments at the University of New Hampshire's Business School. To read his article, The AP Speaks Newspeak, you can visit cursor.org. Professor Mark Harold, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. This show was engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.